On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Let me shock everybody here.
Look, I've been around a long time. People have thrown all kinds of things at me.
I've heard from quite a few people my age that they think you're dishonest.
The enduring symbol of our country is not the barbed wire fence. It is the Statue of Liberty.
I've been on the front lines of change and progress since I was your age.
Yeah, I do think I have the background and the judgment to take this very, very difficult job of being president of the United States.
A little sizzle reel there from the Democratic town hall in Iowa last night. The candidates making their final pitches to Iowans. The all-important caucuses there are now 6 days away. The candidates were not on stage together, which gave former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley a chance to deliver his message uninterrupted.
My candidacy is in your hands. Do with it as you will. But I think it's important, in order to move our country forward, that once again Iowa lift up a new leader so that we can make America the compassionate, generous, and inclusive place that we need it to be. Thanks.
O'Malley there offering his own version of Donald Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders spent time defending his foreign policy credentials.
The most significant vote and issue regarding foreign policy that we have seen in this country in modern history was the vote on the war in Iraq. Okay, that's the fact. I voted against the war in Iraq, and if you go to my website, listen to the speech that I gave when I was in the House in 2002, saying, yeah, it's easy to get rid of a dictator like Saddam Hussein, but there's going to be a political vacuum, there will be instability, and it gives me no pleasure to tell you that much of what I feared, in fact, happened.
Senator Sanders followed up by pointing out that Clinton voted for the war in Iraq, but Hillary Clinton, for her part, offered herself up as a less divisive candidate than Bernie Sanders to a voter who said he was leaning toward Sanders.
It's hard. If it were easy, hey, there wouldn't be any contest. But it's not easy. There are very different visions, different values, different forces at work, and you have to have somebody who is a proven fighter, somebody who has taken them on and won and kept going and will do that as president. That's why I hope you'll reconsider.
We'll soon stop hearing the appeals to Iowa voters and actually find out how they're going to vote. The caucuses are on Monday. And by now, you'd think everything that's needed to be said about Iowa has been said. But one political writer found some more of the innards of Iowa to explore, the places that help make the state what it is. Robert Draper is an author and writer for the New York Times Magazine, for National Geographic, GQ, and others. His latest story for the Times is called Iowa's Heartland, Beyond the Campaign Trail. Welcome, Robert Draper.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
This is essentially a travel piece. And so you go to Iowa, you see a lot of things, you see the sights, as it were. Why not write a more traditional politics story?
Well, because so many of us political journalists pass through Iowa and it gets into our bloodstream a bit, you know, some of the things that we are exposed to. But I frankly had been wanting to go a little bit off the trail and really before we got into the dead heat of the campaign season. So what I did was go in the middle of December to Iowa and just kind of go on a frolic of my own, you know, to various places in Iowa that from now and again are confronted by politicians or politicians confront them, but which in any event give you a sense of the state beyond a gaggle and a tangle of boom mics. Like a lot of political reporters, I've developed an affection for Iowa. It doesn't get the attention that New Hampshire does because the New Hampshire is known for its famously scrutinizing of candidates. But I think that there's a lot of poignancy to the confrontations that take place between the nation's elite when they come to the heartland of America, as it were, and have to basically confront individuals whose lives are affected by the everyday machinations of what takes place in Washington.
I'm going to quote your piece here. Quiet swaths of America's midsection that they would otherwise never deign to visit.
Yeah, I mean, you hear politicians invoke all the time, you know, middle America, ordinary people, you know, the heartland. But they don't set foot on such areas unless and until they need to go there for a fundraiser. But it's a different deal altogether when you actually have to ask people for your vote. And this election season seems to be one that's particularly crucial and on the Republican side above all. I think there's a sense that whoever emerges from Iowa the winner could actually develop the kind of locomotion that's necessary to carry them through the finish line to the nomination. And so the stakes are that much higher. And when you go there, as I have, and see these candidates go to these tiny towns and stand, you know, in front of 100 people in a gymnasium and try to make their case, there's a moment where there's kind of no escape for them where their sincerities or insincerities are, you know, there for all to see. And in that sense, I consider it really a glorious thing.
You didn't just visit the gymnasiums over there. You also visited some out-of-the-way places, some strange places, to be sure. The Herbert Hoover Museum, the Transcendental Meditation Temple, which you wouldn't expect to be in Iowa, right?
Well, in a way, that was the point of it, Stephen. You know, I thought, can we just break through the stereotype? Can we see if Iowa is more than the sum total of its cornfields? And the answer is yes. You know, that Iowa is full of these, you know, sort of unusual, unsung, as I put it, surprises. And those range, as you say, from a presidential museum like the Herbert Hoover one, which I suppose would be expected, except that it's this very, very quiet and kind of sweet place about a failed president who then sort of strives to regain his status as a statesman. And there's a neat kind of intellectual honesty to that place, not to mention one of the few presidential libraries you can go to and actually wander around, you know, without being elbow to elbow with others. But there are as well places like this little town, Coon Rapids, where Nikita Khrushchev came in 1959 to visit a corn farmer because he wanted to learn more about agricultural techniques as a means of avoiding a famine. And this particular farmer, Roswell Garst, invited him into his household at some risk. I mean, people called him a communist sympathizer as a result. But again, you know, that you would find in the middle of Iowa a place where the premier of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, had visited seems quite surprising. For that matter, just a few miles down the road in a little town called Templeton, there was a place I discovered where a lot of the great Prohibition-era bootleggers came from. And in fact, the whiskey that they made was favored by Al Capone. So these sort of belie the notion of, you know, kind of rock-ribbed, everyday agricultural American. I mean, there's a lot more to see than just that.
I'll bet you when Khrushchev came to Coon Rapids, the Enterprise newspaper covered that big story, didn't it?
They certainly did, yes. And I went by the Coon Rapids Enterprise, and because, frankly, I had trouble finding where the Garst farmstead was, and the editor-in-chief was kind enough to sort of show me the directions, and as it turns out, it's now a bed and breakfast and you know, a very, very quaint place with all these history plaques and explanatory plaques that give you a sense of this rather historic, rather unusual meeting. And this is in an area that, you know, is essentially the Corn Belt, where you're loath to find Uber, where you're even out of cell range most of the time. And it has these lonely, you know, and long expanses of cornfields and of dairy fields, but at the same time, where if you just look a little bit harder, you're apt to find some unusual things.
You mentioned corn and you mentioned breakfast in one breath there, Robert, which and there's a lot of eating apparently that goes on in Iowa, from the state fair right outside
right.
of Des Moines to other places where these candidates go to meet the real folk, right? Don't they do that?
That's exactly right. And while in the city of Des Moines you're apt to find all sorts of fine dining, it's basically the case that Iowans are very, very clever about deploying a sort of multiple calorie effect. I mean, basically, if they can, you know, I went to a place where there weren't just milkshakes, they were pie milkshakes. So it's basically pies floating around in milkshakes.
Oh,
another place.
Wow.
Where
why did you put that out there, Robert? Now, I want that.
Yeah. No, it's pretty good. And there was another place that had a cheeseburger chowder, which is exactly what it sounds like. It looked quite delicious, but, you know, I knew that it would take about 7 or 8 fiscal quarters to probably digest that. So,
certainly to burn it off. That's a lot of time on the treadmill, I'm sure.
It is. That's right. But you know, these are these places, whether it's the Hamburg Inn number 2, which has the pie shakes, or Smoky Rogue Coffee House, which has the cheeseburger chowder, or the Pizza Ranch, which has these endless buffet tables of pizzas and fried chicken, where you'll see a Rick Santorum or a Mike Huckabee or a Donald Trump or Carly Fiorina come in and subject themselves to a Q&A and to some degree a photo op and ask for people's votes. And so yeah, people manage to get in their dining and their inquisitions at the same time.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how eating bad food becomes sort of a way for candidates to prove that they're real folk, right? That they're authentic, if you will.
Well, let me just tell you, as someone who has traveled on these campaign buses, it's an unavoidable occupational hazard, really, you know, to be eating nothing but brown food that you know, more or less has a digestible quality of plutonium. And so, by contrast, some of the restaurants in Iowa are quite good compared to what you'll eat on a campaign bus.
So tell me what the upshot is here. I mean, by writing about the unsung surprises of Iowa, are you saying anything bigger about the United States at large? Do you see something in the country inside Iowa?
Yeah, I think what you see is a beauty that to some degree fortifies the stereotype that we frankly hold dear about the middle of America. But you also see, you know, within its creases, aspects of it that will suggest to you why a portion of middle America does not necessarily mean that, say, it's so conservative. In fact, it ranks 24th amongst the states that identify themselves as most conservative. Iowa, of course, went for Obama in 2008 and 2012, and yet, you know, where one drives throughout the midsection of the state in the agricultural belt, one's loath to find, you know, people who would be big fans of Obama. But the point really being, Stephen, the more you plumb the depths of Iowa, the more you're gratified by the discovery that, in fact, there are depths, that there are eccentricities to the place. And we haven't even spoken, by the way, about the John Wayne Museum, you know, which is worth the price of admission of going to Iowa just by itself, just to see the big statue of the Duke outside. So there's a lot that actually rewards a visitor. But what I wanted to do is write about Iowa in the context of the political season so that people would get a sense as they're thinking about politics and thinking about the fact that Iowa is the first in the nation to deliver votes, what that actually means, what it means that these individuals are the ones who have that responsibility. And so it was sort of with that in mind that I wanted to spend more and more time with ordinary and not so ordinary Iowans.
Well, it's a beautifully written piece, Robert Draper, author and writer for the New York Times Magazine, for other publications as well, National Geographic, GQ. Robert, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Stephen.
Well, from Iowa to Texas now, with definite political implications, a grand jury in the Lone Star State shocked the country yesterday. That panel was tasked with investigating Planned Parenthood over videos that purported to show officials selling fetal tissue to undercover anti-abortion activists. But it decided to indict the activists instead of Planned Parenthood officials. The indictments relate to the surreptitiously recorded videos. Abortion has been, of course, a political hot button since Roe v. Wade back in the early 1970s. And despite the divisiveness of the issue, abortion keeps coming up again and again on the campaign trail. Here to talk about it, Rebecca Traister is a writer-at-large for New York Magazine. She covers the issue of reproductive rights. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the news of these indictments yesterday from Texas. What did this grand jury find?
Well, they went into it investigating Planned Parenthood itself. The videos that were released by this undercover group this summer purported to show the illegal sale for profit of fetal parts. And there was a lot of political rhetoric around it, and this Texas grand jury was tasked with determining whether or not to indict anybody involved in Planned Parenthood with the illegal sale of fetal parts. And instead, I think to everybody's shock, this Texas grand jury cleared Planned Parenthood of wrongdoing and instead indicted two of the people involved with the undercover videos.
Was that on the table, Rebecca? Did anybody know that was a possibility, that could happen?
I didn't. I can't answer that comprehensively. Maybe somebody did. I think, as far as I know, it was a surprise to a lot of people.
Do you think the attack on Planned Parenthood is backfiring on
Yes.
Republicans who just this summer, and you mentioned the politicalization of all of this, right, where they were using these videos to bolster their arguments to defund Planned Parenthood?
Right. I mean, I think it depends on your perspective. I think that there's a lot of evidence that these attacks are backfiring. One thing that was already sort of traceable in the early fall as these videos came to light was that Planned Parenthood's approval ratings were not only staying high and were sort of untouched by these videos, they were Planned Parenthood was gaining slightly in approval, and their approval ratings, even after the release of these videos, were higher than that of like the entire Republican Party, the entire Democratic Party, higher than pretty much any political figure in the country. People really love Planned Parenthood, which is something that is very hard for lots of pundits and lots of politicians and lots of strategists to absorb. I think one of the arguments that we're seeing played out here is abortion actually as divisive an issue as we've been told repeatedly that it is? And so one of the things that we're watching is the possibility that perhaps it's not as divisive and that people are very interested in standing behind Planned Parenthood and that politicians might campaign more aggressively in favor of reproductive rights, which I think we're seeing happen with Democratic presidential nominees.
Well, on the Democratic side, sure, but on the Republican side, to be
right.
sure, there are candidates who are galvanized right now, even in light of yesterday's announcement from Texas, Senator Marco Rubio. I'm disturbed, he said. We'll need to learn more, but I'm disturbed that while Planned Parenthood, this is a quote, who are the ones that were actually selling off these parts were found having done nothing wrong. The people who tried to expose them are the ones that are now facing criminal charges. Carly Fiorina, from what I read, quote, somehow the charge is that they falsified government identities, because that's true, obviously, that's not good, but I only know what I read at this point, but I think it's pretty clear that we now know what goes on in Planned Parenthood clinics. So they are bolstering even in the wake of what happened yesterday.
Well, Carly Fiorina has been digging in tight on this for a while. I mean,
she said she saw the tape, right? She said she saw the tape.
Yeah, she's the person who kept insisting that a version of a video existed when all viewable evidence proved her wrong. She's really dug in on this. I think one of the things we're seeing happen is that insofar as Democrats are moving to the left, right, and Republicans this cycle in the presidential cycle are certainly moving to the right. I mean, what we're seeing is a sort of radical right energy happening on the Republican side. And up until very recently, and I think what we're seeing, what you're describing, is a continuation of that, they're really betting on anti-abortion sentiment so hard that they have moved to this radical new point where lots of the primary candidates on the Republican side were trying to outdo each other really more aggressively than I've ever heard before on, for example, abortion restrictions, trying to accuse each other of being weak because they support, you know, another candidate as for being weak for supporting an exception for the life of the mother or for rape and incest. I mean, that is a new level of virulent anti-abortion activist sentiment from politicians that we haven't seen before. So they are really betting on the opposite, which is that they are going to excite their very conservative, radically right base by going harder than ever before.
Harder than ever before. But I thought they were coming back. They were walking it back from women's issues after getting burned in 2012 with you remember legitimate rape and shut that thing down and all of that.
Well, they were supposed to be getting better about not making stupid comments about rape. That's one of the things that they've been trying to get better on. And there's been mixed direction in that regard. They were supposed to walk all that back in 2012, but then in 2014, when the Republicans won very big in the midterms, there was a lot of conventional wisdom, which I think was badly interpreted, suggesting that the war on women rhetoric deployed by the left wasn't working for Democrats anymore. And so Republicans may have overbet on that, or they may just not care, because in fact we are really looking at several of the people who are dominating the Republican side. They seem to be really, truly, authentically radical conservatives on these issues and more.
You said that people are paying attention to this, that the Planned Parenthood numbers actually went up during the whole last summer, last fall. How important is this issue, Rebecca, to women voters in this presidential election year?
Well, that's a question that lots of people have opinions about. I mean, conventional wisdom for Democrats who've always been on the side of reproductive rights has always been to tread carefully around it. Even up through, I mean, the war on women that we saw, the war on women rhetoric that we saw in 2012, which was very effective for them, was about as bold as I'd ever seen them before. But it was around things like rape and birth control. There was still a little bit of a hesitation about centering abortion, right? And so you can see this in Democratic Party politics, and also even in the pro-choice movement. The language of choice has been very sort of fuzzy. It's about choice. There's been a care. We treat abortion as a tragic and sad event. What we're seeing this year is a little bit more boldness. There's some polling that has been done that people like Elise Hoge, who's the president of NARAL, has been trying to communicate to people on the Democratic side, saying, wait a minute, if you ask people questions the right way, it turns out they're much more supportive of abortion rights than we previously thought. And her argument is that I believe something like 70%, 7 out of 10 Democratic voters, or 7 out of 10 voters, care very deeply and are pro-choice in terms of how they vote. And she believes that the Democrats should be centering this issue more clearly. And you see Hillary Clinton doing that. Hillary Clinton is taking, for example, an extremely aggressive stance on the Hyde Amendment, which has been around since the 1970s and which prevents federal money from being used for abortion services. And Hillary Clinton has come out very strongly in a way I've never heard a mainstream presidential candidate ever come out before, saying, I oppose this, and really explaining why, that it's an issue of economic inequality.
Sure, sure. It sounds like both sides are galvanized. That's what it sounds to me, that both sides are digging in.
And both sides are talking about it in entirely new ways. It's a really interesting moment.
Well, it's going to be an interesting election year, to be sure. Thank you so much, Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large at New York Magazine. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You bet. So are you glad to see abortion in the spotlight, or do you wish that the candidates would avoid the debate entirely? What do you think? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, President Obama has outlined solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons. And the Supreme Court also made a ruling about juvenile offenders this week. We'll have the details next on Press Play.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, filling in for Madeline Brand today. There were a couple of big decisions this week that emerged about the treatment of children in the American criminal justice system. Through executive order, President Obama banned the use of solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons. And in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that mandatory minimum life sentences cannot be applied to juveniles. Yesterday, the court made that ruling retroactive as well, another decision. That means state courts will have to hold new sentencing hearings for anyone now serving a mandatory life sentence they were given even as a minor, even decades ago. Marsha Levick is deputy director and chief counsel at the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
You bet. Let's start with solitary confinement. I know the president wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post yesterday citing the case of a boy named Khalif Browder, who was 16 years old when he was accused of stealing a backpack. He was sent to Rikers Island in New York, a big, famous, tough prison. He never stood trial, but he spent 3 years in prison there, almost two of them in solitary confinement. He committed suicide after he was released. The president's decision affects federal prisons where there are only about a dozen juveniles being held in solitary in the entire country. How unusual is it for juveniles to be placed in solitary confinement?
Well, there aren't many juveniles in the federal system generally, but there are tens of thousands of juveniles in the juvenile justice system, and many of them, hundreds and sometimes thousands of them in any given year, may be placed in solitary confinement. So the president's executive order has an immediate limited effect, but it stands for a very significant proposition and provides national leadership on a critically important issue.
Well, it sounds like national leadership, sure, and the op-ed, obviously, in the Washington Post. And I wonder, and I want to talk about Kalief Browder, because it sounds like he was placed in solitary to protect him from other inmates. Is that,
sure,
is that a consideration?
Well, I think that it all depends how you do it. So, yes, and I think the president references in his op-ed, he talks about placing individuals in solitary, or it's really not about placing them in solitary, but sometimes separating them from the general population for their own protection, in extreme cases, to protect the safety of others in the facility. But there's a difference between isolating someone, stripping them of any human interaction, of any programming, any opportunity to receive counseling or services, or separating them for their own protection, but allowing them to engage with others, to participate in programming within the prison or within the juvenile justice facility.
Let's hone in on being isolated, on isolating them. Is it even worse for minors psychologically than it is for an adult?
Yes. I mean, everything that happens to us as individuals is exacerbated when it happens to us as children, because our psyches are still forming, our brains are still forming, the consequences can be more long-lasting. And there's ample research that demonstrates that the kind of trauma and damage and harm that solitary confinement can inflict on a person will likely be exaggerated in the case of children.
How do states define a juvenile? Do they have different ages?
Most states define juveniles as individuals who commit criminal conduct under the age of 18. Kalief Browder's story was particularly tragic because New York is one of only two states in the country, New York and North Carolina, that treat all 16 and 17-year-olds, as well as those over 18, as adults. So Kalief was in the adult criminal justice system, sent to Rikers, and obviously subjected to horrific conditions of confinement there.
I'm curious, Marcia, as to whether the president's decision, you know, we live in such a galvanized society now, politically anyway, when the president comes out with an executive order, and that's almost coded language on the right, that states, especially those with Republican governors, will say, wait a second, it's the president overreaching again. We're not going to go along with this. Does that have any effect, do you think?
I think there's a risk of that, but let me say something about how policy gets made. So first of all, we know that there's criminal justice reform legislation that has been introduced in Congress that tracks and, in fact, I think provided some of the guidelines that the president put forward in his executive order. At the state level, governors have some control, but a lot of this, a lot of the making of policy is also done through other executive agencies. It can be done in some instances through juvenile justice officials. So it's possible that despite some political opposition, that we may yet see individuals at the state level who are running juvenile justice systems who will see the benefit and the smart policy behind the decisions that the president issued yesterday.
It sounds like sausage factory stuff, right? Like going forward.
Yes.
Yeah, policy.
Yes.
Here in California, I know there was a settlement back in September that should scale back the use of solitary confinement pretty significantly. At that time, there were nearly 3,000 inmates being held in solitary. Do you know if there were many juveniles among them here in this state?
I don't think there were very many juveniles. But, you know, I think it's also important to recognize the settlement in California, because it involved adults in the criminal justice system. It scaled back solitary, although solitary in California can still be measured in years. And what I think is so important about what the president did in his executive order for juveniles is that he essentially said no solitary under the most extreme set of circumstances, an immediate response to an emergency situation up to 3 hours. That's extraordinary to have that kind of a standard set where we are essentially saying, you know what, you can't lock kids in a closet.
What does this Supreme Court ruling from yesterday say, this ruling that came out yesterday?
So the Supreme Court yesterday followed up on its 2012 decision that you mentioned in your intro that banned mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles who had been convicted of homicide offenses. It was unclear at the time whether or not that ruling would extend back to individuals whose convictions were final, appeals were final prior to 2012, many of whose cases go back decades, some as far back as the 1950s, and they've been in prison for decades. And so we were unsure whether or not that would be retroactive. A majority of state Supreme Courts said that it was, but a half a dozen or so, including Louisiana, including my state of Pennsylvania, said that it was not. So yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a ruling in which it said that, in fact, Miller, which the court decided in 2012, must be applied retroactively, and that means that approximately 2,000 individuals across the country who are serving mandatory life without parole sentences for crimes they committed as children will now have an opportunity for a second look, hopefully for resentencing, for an opportunity for parole, and for a chance at hope.
We're talking to Marsha Levick, who's the Deputy Director and Chief Counsel at the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia. Marsha, I do want to ask you that California does have mandatory minimum life without parole or death penalty sentence for first-degree murder. Under special circumstances, I know that term, special circumstances, can that also apply to juveniles?
Well, the death penalty, absolutely not. And no mandatory life without parole sentence can now be imposed on juveniles. And that was true following the Supreme Court's decision in 2012. California has a lot of mandatory minimum sentencing provisions. In many instances, when those provisions are applied to juveniles, they can be stacked, which means that juveniles can receive what is technically not a life without parole sentence, but receive a sentence that can exceed 50, 70, even 100 years in some cases. The California Supreme Court has responded in the most extreme cases and indeed struck a sentence of 112 years as being effectively life without parole. But there are many opportunities for extreme sentences left in California, and I think that we'll see those cases litigated through the California courts.
It's so interesting to me. How do you see these two decisions, just the decisions this week, including the SCOTUS decision, fit into the larger effort to reform the criminal justice system overall?
I think that they are part of a larger story, but I think as someone who advocates specifically on behalf of kids in the justice system, this has been a pretty remarkable journey that we've been on since 2005 when the Supreme Court struck the juvenile death penalty. The court has rewritten how we think about children under the Constitution and what the permissible boundaries of sentencing are under the Constitution. So we are thrilled with the court's decision yesterday, thrilled with, as I said, Obama at least taking national leadership on the solitary confinement issue, and our work is cut out for us. We see problems and opportunities ahead.
All right, Marsha Levick from the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
What do you think about the changes in the way we treat juvenile offenders? Call us toll-free, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us, KCRW Press Play. That's at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Tallulah is a new film about women in tough spots and a kidnapping.
I wrote the movie because I worked as a nanny at a lot of the high-end hotels in L.A. when I first moved out to L.A., and I had a lot of really weird encounters with really weird moms.
It's day two of our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We'll have that after a news update right now with KCRW's Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Madeline Brand at the Sundance Film Festival. You know, Sundance is all about buzz, and one of the buzziest movies here now is a movie called Tallulah. It stars Ellen Page in the title role. They call her Lou in the movie. Lou is a young woman who lives out of her van. Her boyfriend she was traveling with has just left her, sick of the lifestyle. One night, scavenging for food at a fancy New York hotel, Lou is mistaken by a drunk rich woman for a housekeeper. And the woman convinces Lou to look after her toddler so she can go meet a man and have a good time. So, thinking she's rescuing the baby, Lou impulsively takes off with her. Nowhere to turn, She goes to her boyfriend's mom for help and claims that the baby is her grandchild. Tallulah is about the lives of three broken women and three women who don't really know how to be good mothers. This is Shawn Hader's first feature film. Her day job is writing on Orange is the New Black, and she's a young mother herself. I sat down with Shawn in a busy lounge yesterday, just after she had screened the movie. Talk a little bit about your view of motherhood, because the moms in this movie, you come away from it and you think, she has a kind of a dim view of motherhood, or at least what it's like to be a mom.
Well, my views on motherhood sort of changed over the course of the inception of the movie and then getting the movie made. When I wrote the movie because I worked as a nanny at a lot of the high-end hotels in L.A. when I first moved out to L.A., and I had a lot of really weird encounters with really weird moms. And I had a lot of judgment about these women. I was showing up and dealing with these rich women, and their kids looked like accessories. They were these kind of Beverly Hills housewife people who had, you know, their kids were in Prada and had matching onesies to whatever their outfit was. And a lot of times they wouldn't even ask my name. Like, I'd show up and they'd sort of go, hey, there she is. And I had spent many a night with a child who, and they never told me the name of the child. And there was a particular mother who was so disturbing that I actually considered taking her child. And I didn't, but I thought about who would and ended up writing a movie about that. But I really wrote the movie from a place of judgment, of kind of feeling like this character of Carolyn didn't deserve to have a child and got pregnant for the wrong reasons. And
just to explain, Carolyn is the rich woman who hires Tallulah or inveigles her to take care of her baby while she goes out on a rendezvous and ends up coming home drunk and obviously, you know, exhibiting signs of being a really bad mom. And Tallulah decides she's going to take the baby to, I don't know, protect her, I guess, from this mom.
Yeah, she sort of rescues the baby in her own mind, I think. But it's, you know, to the rest of the world, it's kidnapping. So I think I was just super interested in this kind of neglect that was occurring in high society and that was hidden because of nannies and maids and housekeepers, and there was almost protection. Like, when we think of neglect, I think we think of it, you know, poor moms who are working a lot of jobs and substance abuse, and there was a kind of neglect happening that was hidden, and I was interested in exploring that. But I, over the course of it, took many years to get the movie made, and over the course of that time, I became a mom, and my daughter had colic for the first 3 months, and it was incredibly rough, and I was sort of cocky about being a mom. I think I'd been a nanny, and I'd been, you know, I was really good with kids, and I was like, we got this. You know, my husband and I are like, we're gonna nail this, and it was so challenging, and it kind of knocked us both sideways, and I think I went back and I rewrote the script because I felt like it wasn't a clear villain anymore. It was a more nuanced character. I think I had a lot more compassion for Carolyn. I had a lot more compassion for all of the women in the movie and their relationship to motherhood and their own mothers. And, you know, here I am making this film about, you know, neglect and about these complex issues around it, and I am leaving my daughter to go make the movie. You know, there were so many levels of that. I was breast pumping in the bathroom right before I came over here. You know, it's kind of like you're at the Sundance Film Festival with your film and having this premiere, and I've got these two little kids with me, and so it's really a juggle. And I think it's interesting that my life, these things happened in my life at the same time that I was making this film, and that, you know, a lot of the issues in the film have kind of been borne out in my own life in an interesting way. And since we've screened it, since we premiered, I can't tell you the weirdest conversations I've had where women have been pulling me aside in bathrooms and confessing to me these sort of feelings about motherhood that they haven't been able to express. You know, one woman the other day pulled me aside literally in the handicapped bathroom, and she said, I can't tell you, I had my baby and I didn't feel the things I thought I was supposed to feel, and it took me a long time to feel that mommy feeling, and I felt like I was a bad mom and I was failing, and I'm sort of standing there like, you know, trying to wash my hands. But it's pretty amazing, and I think it started a lot of conversations about that. I think there's a different side to motherhood that I think a lot of women are afraid to talk about or express, and I think the movie has started conversations about that, and it's been fascinating for me.
Now, there's been so much talk recently about women in Hollywood and the fact that this is a man's world, a white man's world largely. I wonder if you could address that, especially since you've made a movie that is about women. Mm-hmm. Primarily, and the main character is a woman. You are a woman. Your producer is a woman. I know. I hate to break to you. Your name is Sean, but you're a woman. can you address that and how you feel about what's happening and how it relates to your particular situation in your movie?
I think, look, we're 50% of the population, and we have stories that need to be told that are interesting. And I think the more diverse voices you put behind the camera, I think, you know, I hired a lot of women on my film. My DP was a woman. My production designer, my producer, my AD, my gaffer was a woman. You know, I really thought when, if you lined us all up, you'd be like this, you know, it challenged those traditional ideas of the white guy in the baseball cap behind the monitor. And I'm so glad it's part of the conversation. I'm glad that reporters are asking about it and writing about it. I think, you know, it has yet to translate it into hiring practices, and hopefully that conversation is going to start changing things. I was on a panel yesterday of women in film, and Maggie Greenwald was on the panel, and she was saying she started directing in 1987, and the numbers are exactly the same as they were then. So I hope that women who are in power, studio execs and showrunners, and start hiring more women. I think that's gonna be a groundswell that can happen. But I also just think, you know, my job is to tell good stories and to make good work that moves people. And hopefully, you know, that cultural shift is gonna happen.
Do you feel like you have to fight harder?
Hell yeah. You know, I think particularly in wrangling money, because I was a young woman, you know, I'm going out and I'm in my late 20s and I'm meeting with these money guys and I'm asking them to give me millions of dollars, you know, and it's kind of going, you've got to trust me with this and you've got to hand it over and know that I'm going to make your money back for you and I'm going to succeed in that. And I think, of course, men... A lot of those men have an issue.
So what would you say to them? I mean, here you are, a young woman, you know, asking them to part with their millions. And they're looking at you like, what?
I mean, all I can say is, like, the proof is in the pot. Like, I made your money back. There you go. You have it back now. We can go make another movie. So, I was lucky to find financiers and producers that were really cool. And they let me make the movie that I wanted to make. And... you know, I found out I was pregnant, and I was so nervous about them finding out I was pregnant, because that's probably the worst fear of anyone hiring a woman director, is like, she's going to go get pregnant. And they were cool about it. And I, you know, directed the movie when I was 6 months pregnant. I locked picture. I went into labor the night that I locked picture. I literally left the editing room at 3 p.m. and went into labor at 9 p.m. So I think my baby deserves producer credit, probably, because he's stuck to our post schedule in a really big way.
Well, Sean Hader, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Hader, director of the new movie, Tallulah.
Madeline Brand reporting from the Sundance Film Festival. Well, coming up tomorrow, virtual reality is the hot new thing in filmmaking. Madeline tries out a whole new movie-going experience. Warren Olney is here right now for a look at what's on To The Point coming up in just a few minutes. Hi, Warren.
Ah, it's a whole new press play experience.
It
to
is,
do here,
absolutely.
And I appreciate it. We're going to be talking about environmental and health crises in Flint, Michigan with the water, in West Virginia with the water, and in California with the natural gas leak. And all of those involve failures of one kind or another by the Environmental Protection Agency.
All right. We will talk about it coming up shortly on To The Point. Warren Olney, thank you so much. Coming up on this show, how an Instagram hoax made it to the Tate Modern Museum. Just ahead.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
All right, this is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis in for Madeline Brand. The next frontier for performance art is Instagram. Artist Amalia Ullman ran a months-long experiment on Instagram. Some are calling it a simple Insta hoax. Others are comparing Ullman's work to that of famed performance artist Cindy Sherman. We're going to let you decide how to characterize it with the help of Nora Kaplan-Bricker, who is a contributing writer for Slate.com. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. So, Nora, start by describing Amalia Ullman's Instagram account. What kind of pictures are up there, and how did this hoax begin?
So this was an idea that she apparently had when she was in art school, but didn't have the money to realize it until last year. And her idea was to basically weave together the three most common sort of Instagram and social media personas that women kind of borrow from or emulate online, and weave them together into one story. So the first one is a sort of ingenue character, sort of very, very feminine. And then the second one, and so she played that character kind of coming to LA and wanting to break into modeling.
So she moved to LA. She moved to LA to become a model. And then she's exhibiting this now on Instagram.
Well, so she actually is an artist, but she sort of constructed, and she was already already there, but she constructed this character who had just arrived in LA. And I think for new followers who were catching on and didn't know her, this looked totally believable to them. This sort of super bubbly young woman, all her pictures are sort of pink washed, arriving in LA, talking about how great it is, wanting to be a model. And then the second act of this project and the second character that she emulates is a sort of crashing towards rock bottom, very familiar from a lot of celebrity coverage and tabloids and things like that. And so she faked sort of body image issues and a breast augmentation surgery and a drug problem. And she presented herself as someone who was doing escort work to make money and then having a mental breakdown and all these things. And, you know, she's gaining followers. And then the third section was the kind of rebuild and renewal section and character that she says was inspired by Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop blog. And so the pictures in that third phase become like a lot of avocados and meditation and hashtag healthy, hashtag namaste, things like that. And so I think the part of the genius of it is that it is one narrative, but it really covers a lot of ground in terms of the way that women are kind of socialized to present themselves online in these sort of different siloed characters.
I'm curious, Nora, whether or not anybody was concerned for Amalia.
I think that's a good question. And when you look at the comments, certainly there were people commenting on the photos, things along the lines of, you know, you're beautiful, you're great, don't let them get you down, you know, take care of yourself. But I think those comments are generally overwhelmed by the comments that show kind of the aid of human behavior online that are sort of...
This is like the comment section of YouTube, right? Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
Those things you don't want to read on the internet.
Exactly. And so when you look at this, there's sort of some compassion on there, but also a whole lot of either, you know, disdain for her behavior or people who seem to just be really envious of the fact that she's attractive or sort of urging her on in her self-destructive behavior. And she has also said that in her real life, it's not so much that she received concern, but more that she received feedback from people she knew professionally that, oh, you have to stop doing this because people won't take you seriously anymore. And these are people who didn't know it was a hoax, but thought this was her real online persona. And their concern was just for, you know, they thought she was making herself look like an idiot.
Well, I mean, and to be sure, she was doing this in real time. It may have been a hoax, but, I mean, those same people could probably tell her, you know, we'll never be able to know if you're being truthful or not, right? I mean, isn't there something a little upsetting about letting her followers think that this was real?
I think that's really interesting. And I would argue, because she is an artist, and most of the people who signed on didn't know her personally. They were just kind of interested in the story and interested in the images, that it was a totally kind of ethical and above board use of social media. And one of the points that she makes through the project, of course, is that we're sort of all performing on social media. And so, you know, certainly this was a pretty extreme performance, but not necessarily outside the realm of what those platforms are maybe even intended to be used for, or are kind of in general the nature of the way those platforms are used.
What was the reveal like, Nora? Was it like, surprise? I mean, what? How did that go on Instagram? How do you reveal something on Instagram anyway? Do you take a selfie of a smile? Or, I mean, I don't know.
I think it was really, really well done on her part because, and this also gets back to your question about sort of the ethics of this, before she started posting these pictures that were, really about a character and not about herself, she had just this kind of unannotated image that said part one. And then after that, it becomes not her. It becomes this character who's being represented. And then at the very end of the whole thing, which lasted about 5 months, she posted a black and white photo of a rose, which is very much kind of in the vein of the kinds of images that were being posted. And that that image, her comment on it, kind of explains everything that she was doing, and that this is an artwork, and she calls it excellences and perfections, and really lays the whole thing out there. But even in that case, it's within the context of Instagram itself.
Is Instagram art, though? I mean, I wonder, because we're talking a couple of exhibits in London at the Tate Modern, and then another at the Whitechapel Gallery there overseas. Is this art, really, an Instagram exhibit?
So the exhibits themselves, the one at the Tate will go it looks at art and performance going back a number of decades, and certainly some things that maybe paintings that when they were first exhibited, abstract expressionist paintings and things like that, that people had similar questions about, is this art? But now we certainly recognize them to be art. And I think maybe the jury is out on whether, history will consider this to be art, but I would argue that it very much is, and that one thing that's really clever about it is that it uses this new form of social media to sort of create a provocation in a setting where people come to it not expecting it to be art, or not expecting it to be sort of fully thought out and manufactured. And so the responses to it, it has sort of an element of a social science experiment as well, in that people kind of let it all hang out in their responses to it in a way you might not come into it in a museum.
Is she getting hammered? I know she has 100. Okay. Thank you so much, Nora Kaplan-Bricker, a contributing writer for Slate Magazine. Nora, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to say she has 100,000 followers on Instagram, which is amazing. Hey, that's it for us on Press Play for today. I'm Steve Chiatakis. To the Point is coming up next. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, have a great day.
KCRW thanks Acura for supporting our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival.